The thing that just keeps me grounded and able to move forward is focusing on the music and focusing on the song and focusing on the people that I'm creating with. And if I'm doing that, then it's much harder for that stuff to kind of get in and get in the way, because then my focus and my intentions are true and they're genuine to who I'm trying to be. And I think for anyone struggling with that, you know, that can really be the thing that turns it around, because suddenly then your brain is not focused on the thing that's trying to slow you down. Your brain is focused on the thing that's going to allow you to move forward. And yeah, if I keep it about the music, if I keep it about the work, that is the thing that keeps me moving forward.
That was Sarah Jarosz, and this is Sheeros, a podcast with a mission. To turn up the volume of women's voices in music across genres and generations, Sheeros is a deep dive into the experiences and perspectives of women and gender-expansive folks in a still overwhelmingly male-dominated music industry. It's a space where we discuss challenges and triumphs, how far we've come, and how far we still have to go. Telling our stories is the first step to making music better for everyone. I'm Carmel Holt. It'll be 15 years ago this May that Texas-born singer, songwriter, mandolin player, and multi-instrumentalist Sarah Jarosz turned 18 years old and a month later released her debut album, Song Up in Her Head, co-produced by Grammy-winning producer and engineer Gary Bachosa, who had also signed Sarah to Sugar Hill Records, and featuring an impressive, star-studded list of contributors, including Chris Thiele, Jerry Douglas, Stuart Duncan, Tim O'Brien, and future I'm With Her bandmate, Aoife O'Donovan. She was immediately hailed as a bluegrass prodigy, reviewed by Rolling Stone and interviewed by Morning Edition, earning her first Grammy nomination for a song from that album the following year, a feat that she's now repeated 10 times over for her solo work, winning 4, as well as 2 nominations and 1 win for a song by I'm With Her. Now, a month away from her 33rd birthday, Sarah Jarosz joins us on Sheeros and reflects on her journey thus far, starting her career in her teens and early 20s, the importance of joining forces with Aoife O'Donovan and Sarah Watkins to form I'm With Her, and how her new album, Polaroid Lovers, her 7th studio release, finds her both breaking new ground by deciding to invite co-writers to work with her for the first time, while simultaneously bringing her full circle to those early days. I'm thrilled to welcome Sarah Jarosz as this week's Shiro in the Spotlight. Sarah Jarosz, welcome to Shiro's. This is quite overdue.
I know. A long time coming. I'm so glad that it's finally happening.
Nice to see you, old friend. And congratulations on this brilliant, gorgeous, incredible new album.
Thank you so much.
Even though this has been a long time coming, it's so worth the wait. And this is like an amazing moment to first have you on the show. Talk to us about Polaroid Lovers. Talk to us about this moment in your already long and storied career.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like an exciting moment. You know, I don't think I could have made this record until now. I felt really ready for it, for the change that it brought and the exploration that it brought. And I don't know, it just took a certain level of confidence in myself to be able to explore in this new way. I mean, with that being said, I feel like I've always tried to be an explorer in my music, and I've never wanted to shut myself off from any options that could be on the table at any given moment. But I just think there are some things about this album that I like to say that it's like I've dipped my toes into the pool in the past, and I just wanted to jump in fully this time. So I do feel like this album was just not being afraid and really going for it for me.
All right, so let's try to expand on that a little bit more and get more specific in some of the new ways that you have opened some new doors. I think the main defining characteristic of this album, right, was all of the co-writes that you did.
Yeah, totally. I think, you know, that was what opened the door for these songs to exist. I think some of it also had to do with the timing of coming out of the pandemic and having so much time alone here in the house where I am talking to you from. And just wanting to get the creative juices flowing again. And I moved to Nashville literally the first week of the pandemic. kind of unknowingly. You know, I was just trying to get out of New York City at the time and then wound up not going back. So I think by the time I started working on this album, I was also curious to just feel more a part of this community and wanting to reach out to some writers that I've admired for so long. And, you know, I think a big part of the co-writing part of this album for me is it's kind of linked to what I was saying earlier about confidence in myself and kind of knowing my own musical voice better at this point in time than I did when I signed my first record deal at 16. You know, I think there was a lot of pressure around me when I was making my first record when I was 17. Managers and label people saying, we want you to write with this person and this person and this person. And I was just always really closed off to it for a long time because I thought, why would I write with someone else when I'm still trying to find my own voice? And, you know, I thought that there was something to be lost at that time. And the thing that could be lost is me finding my own voice and my own identity around what is my music? What is my musical voice? And so especially the co-write with Natalie Hemby felt very full circle to write because I did wind up writing with her in those early days. I had a meeting, a co-write set up with her when I was 17. And, you know, she's amazing and was so warm and made the experience so great. And we actually wrote a song that we talked about again all these years later. But it was so cool to sit down with her again after a decade had passed, more than a decade, and feel like, okay, now I feel like I can bring my soul to this fully and not be afraid of getting lost in the mix. And it feels cool that the song that we wrote was Good at What I Do, because even with that sense of confidence and sort of knowing my voice better, there's still, I think it's just a natural human emotion to think, am I good at what I do? You know, and that just that really raw honesty of self-doubt and self-discovery in the process.
So I was going to ask you to get us started with the song from the record. This was not what I expected to start with today, but I think it's so perfect to set up this story. Before we go into the song, could you share with us a little bit about that first meeting with Natalie? What was it about her then that made you feel safe? And then maybe can you share with us a little bit what that moment was like revisiting that together now?
Well, I mean, she's just such a total pro, you know, and she writes all the time. That's her main thing. She's sitting down with people every day. And so I think there was an element of she just had so much confidence that maybe, but a different type of confidence. So, you know, when you're young, you almost just sort of get swept up into things. It's almost like, I don't know if you felt this way, but it feels less like you're choosing what is happening to you and you're sort of just like getting swept up into the next thing. And I definitely felt that way. I mean, while consciously working very hard on what I did, it was just sort of like, okay, and now I'm here and now I'm here. And there's just so much new information all the time that you're processing, your brain is processing it at a different speed. And so I think she has such an open heart, I would say. And so even though I was sort of processing things differently as a 17-year-old when I sat down with her, I think I immediately felt that open-heartedness from her. And so I felt like I could actually be myself. And so that's the ironic thing of being nervous to go in because I didn't want my voice to get lost, but her warmth and professionalism and just, you know, she's a master at her craft. All of those things were out in the open for me to observe and get to kind of work alongside. And so I felt that she was very giving that day and just opened the door. So we actually talked about the song that we wrote was called The Quick and the Dead. I hope we record it someday because she was like, I still think about that song all these years later and how it stood out to her. And yeah, so then to have the full circle thing of feeling more personally, me feeling more ready for the moment, but then her giving that same energy, it was just a beautiful open-heartedness from two people that kind of allows for this creation.
Am I good at what I do? Do I live up to the kings? Will my words go on forever when my voice no longer sings? Is it all up in my head? Or is it all up to you? I don't really know if I'm good at what I do. Am I good at how I love?
We have Sarah Jaros here with us on Shiros, and the new album is called Polaroid Lovers, her seventh studio release, and that's called Good at What I Do. Right in the start, this caught my eye. Am I good at what I do? Do I live up to the kings? Not to the queens, but do I live up to the kings? Was I catching on to anything there, or was I like seeing something that maybe wasn't there?
Well, you know, I think it's funny because this idea of kings and queens actually also occurs in Jealous Moon, where it's like queen bee buzzing around my right arm, wonder how she keeps her kingdom spinning. And I sort of like the interchangeability of that, where it's like, she's the queen, it's her kingdom. These words can kind of be interchangeable. And so I kind of feel that here with this song. And to give Natalie full credit, I mean, this idea of am I good at what I do was very much her song start. You know, co-writing is always different, and it was different song to song on this whole album, where sometimes you sit down with someone and you kind of come to an idea together in the moment, and you haven't brought an idea that's already started. A lot of times on this album, it was my start that I would bring to the table. But I think because Natalie and I had had that, she was the only person on this album that I had written with before, and all the other ones were first-time co-writes. So I almost feel like she was like, I want to bring something to the table here to kind of have this moment. And so she had that first verse, and then we kind of finished it together from there. But yeah, the kings, I also think maybe there's something there of, I remember, you know, being a little girl first starting playing and often being the only girl in a jam, you know, and kind of like, do I live up to the other guys in the jam, you know, and that kind of self-doubt in that moment of, you know, wanting to be as good as the guys. And, you know, I personally have always, I've been very lucky in that I have felt very supported by almost all of the male musicians who have surrounded me. And I know that that's not everyone's experience, but it's something Aoife and Sarah and I have talked about as well, you know, that we feel really lucky about that. But yeah, so I think maybe that is, some of that is kind of creeping into that line that you observed.
Well, thank you for opening that door to talking about your beginnings. For those that don't know your history, where did you and music first meet up? What was that journey like for you?
My earliest musical memories are of my mom, because my mom played guitar and sang and wrote songs her whole life, just as a hobby. She never pursued it professionally. And I have to give my dad credit too, because he is, I think, you know, I met a lot of people, and I think he's maybe the biggest music lover that I've ever met. So, like, alongside my mom playing and singing, my dad was just always playing albums and talking about the albums. And it was just a very music-filled childhood and house. And there was never a car ride that we ever took together that there wasn't an album playing. You know, we were never sitting in silence as a family. We were listening and singing along. So that was really my initial introduction. It's just my parents, and I'm an only child. And so it was very bonding for us. And it continues to be the thing that really keeps us close to this day. And, you know, and then I was just very lucky to have an incredible music teacher in the school that I went to, elementary school through eighth grade. Her name was Diana Reapy. And that just felt like total luck of the draw, that she was this amazing woman who, she taught using the Kodály method, which is a Hungarian composer, Zoltán Kodály, who believed that every child should have access to a music education, and that music education, as I believe too, can really enrich a child's life. So that was just pure luck that she was at the school that I went to, and she was very formative in those early years for me. And then the other person that I have to give credit to in those early days is a guy named Mike Bond, who was the ringleader of the bluegrass jam that I wound up going to every Friday night. And again, that just felt like good fortune. I grew up in a very, very small town, Wimberley, in the hill country of Central Texas, right outside of Austin. And the fact that there was this bluegrass jam in this tiny town of 2,000 people every Friday night, it was just magical. And it was really, when I started going to that, that was when I started playing mandolin around age 10. That was when I was like, this is what I want to do. This, I love music. I'm obsessed. And there was just this incredible community surrounding me and supporting me in that.
And then you went on to the New England Conservatory for your college education.
Yeah. So my parents were both teachers. They're retired mm-hmm. now. So some of it was them, you know, always placing an importance on going to college and having right. the 4 years of college experience and getting a degree. So part of it was that. But in retrospect, I think also because I had signed my first record deal when I was 16, which seems crazy in retrospect. I mean, you know, when you're 16, you're like, oh, yeah, I'm ready for this. But
how did that even happen? I'm sorry. Wait, we skipped over that. That's really important. How did that even happen?
It happened. So all this time when I'm a teenager, you know, tween, teen, because my parents were teachers, they had the summers off. And because they were big music lovers too, even before I was born, they would go to the Telluride Bluegrass Festival in Colorado and drive up to Colorado from Texas. And we discovered this music camp called Rocky Grass, which is outside of Boulder in Lyons, Colorado. And started going to those camps every summer. And that was also like really life-changing for me because it was the first place that I could meet kids my own age who were doing it rather than just having these older musicians who were playing with me. So fast forward, because I had gone to Rocky Grass and Telluride every summer, I wound up getting a gig when I was 16 at the Telluride Bluegrass Festival, which was totally, you know, up until this point, I had just played shows around Austin, local gigs around Central Texas. I had never really played a huge show in front of 10,000 people. So it was a big turning point. It was a big opportunity. And that's where I met Gary Pachosa, who worked at, it was at the time, it was Sugar Hill Records. And Gary, I knew of because he had engineered so many of the records that I was obsessed with at the time, like Tim O'Brien and Nickel Creek and Alison Krauss. And so, yeah, basically that was just a very fortuitous set. And that was in 2007. And he invited me to come to Nashville. And that's when I signed a record deal. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So this really does actually feel very full circle moment. You just moved to Nashville for the first time. It's like you're kind of returning to Nashville too and putting your roots down there. And this is where it kind of all kicked off for you, no?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very full circle. And that does sort of bring it to the Polaroid Lovers co-writes. I won't skip over the NEC stuff, but no, I had spent tons of time here in Nashville because I made my first four records here. So yeah, basically, long story short, I decided to go to college at New England Conservatory, and I'm so thankful for that in retrospect because I think that if I had gone straight out on the road at 18, which was very much an option on the table, because that was the summer that my first album came out. I don't know. I think I would have burned out and it could have taken a different turn. And I think that the 4 years at NEC almost served as this barrier and kind of this little cocoon of time. It was still an insane 4 years. And I was, you know, I never was there for spring break. I was always making a record or I was touring in any of my time off. But it still gave me this kind of more normal life for a little bit. And I think ultimately kept me grounded to have those 4 years. And musically, to be pushed. And like you said, I had come from this acoustic folk bluegrass world. And then I get to NEC and I'm learning Billie Holiday and Abby Lincoln and, you know, Ornette Coleman songs, you know, this whole other side of music that I hadn't really spent time with. And so it very much pushed me out of my comfort zone, introduced me to all these people. It just made me feel really a part of the community that I had very much been a part of as a teen. And then it was able to kind of blossom into this bigger thing and ultimately allowed me to do what I'm doing today. It's funny because a lot of, like Aoife, for instance,
right,
went to NEC. All of the Lake Street Dive people went to NEC, but I'm a little younger than them. So they had all left by the time that I was there. The majority of my social life outside of school were people that went to Berkeley. And I think right. that was just because what I just said, many of the people that I had met at Rocky Grass, at the Mandolin Symposium, at Shasta Camp, all wound up going to Berkeley. And I decided on NEC because, I don't know, I just felt that it would push me out of my comfort zone a little more musically. But Aoife kind of became a big sister person in my life because she and I met, I think, when I was 14 or 15. And I remember we had this kind of bonding experience at this camp called Shasta Camp in California. And I don't know, she had gone to NEC and kind of encouraged me to go that route. So that was definitely a part of that decision.
I love that so much. And it's easy to forget how young you are because your career goes back so far. Let's take a break here in conversation and go to music. What track do you want to play next?
I would love to play The Way It Is Now. So I wrote this with Sarah Buxton, who I lied before. I had written with Sarah once. The reason that I met Sarah was through our mutual friend, Jed Hughes, who I had written with and played with on some of my previous albums, great guitar player and singer here in Nashville. And I remembered loving her vibe, and I wanted to reach out to her to write for this album. And I don't know, we had a deep, deep, beautiful day together. She goes deep fast, and we had some beautiful conversations and drank tea and ultimately wound up writing this song about just trying to be in the moment. You know, it's hard these days. It's hard any day, but it feels like especially with social media, you know, there's a line at the beginning that's in my head in my stories, which I liked because it kind of is a double meaning, like in the stories that I tell myself, but also literally it could mean like Instagram stories. And that kind of, you wake up, you're scrolling, the day hasn't even started and you're already comparing yourself to somebody else. And then ultimately kind of getting to this point of, she and I have both dabbled in meditation. And I think especially during the pandemic, it was something that helped me a lot. And using it as this tool of just, all I have is this moment. That's all I want to pay attention to. And if I'm getting bogged down by comparing myself to other people or by the stressors that lie ahead of trying to make plans and trying to sort of create this great life, quote unquote, just letting that fall away and focus on your breath and focus on the moment. And this song is what came out of that conversation. And it's emotional for me. It's been this and also Columbus in 89th are the two songs on the record that it's almost difficult for me to sing them without crying because they really tapped into something so real for me and also, I think, for a lot of people. So I really love this song.
Waking up with this feeling like everyone's figured it out except me. In my head, in my stories, heart so heavy I forget to breathe. Determining future, like anyone knows what's around the bend. I can stand still, I can change like the wind. This is the way it is.
That's The Way It Is Now. My favorite part of the song lyrically is, this is the way it is now. It's a hard time, but it's our time. And someday we'll be looking back, missing the way that it is now. Oh, talk about emotional. Like,
yeah.
It totally made me tear up.
Aw, it's a doozy.
Sarah Jarosz, our guest today on She Rose, and the new album is Polaroid Lovers, her 7th studio release. I'm Carmel Holt. You're talking, as we're going into the song, about how emotional this song is, as well as Columbus and 89th, which we absolutely should include in our time together today. And I thought, I saw this somewhere in one of the many articles that I read in getting ready to talk to you today. Somebody said, each song serves as a moment in time with little glimpses of the person she was bubbling underneath the surface of the artist she has become. And I thought that was so well phrased, but I wondered how that landed for you.
I love it. I think that feels correct to me, you know, because I think it's all this full circle energy that we've kind of been talking about. you know, I think because this is my seventh record, it really was my first chance. And I've even felt this in my live shows, kind of constructing my set list for the live show and trying to figure out what older songs of mine that I want to put in the set. It's the first time in my musical life that I have the good problem of having too many songs to fit into one night of music. So I think kind of connected to that, it is really the first time that I feel like I have enough work to look back on and to kind of look back at my younger self. And that's the thing, just honoring the younger version of ourselves, I think, is important and something that I've worked on, because I think starting a career so young, it would be easier for me to look back and say, oh God, I can't listen to my early records. Like, what was she thinking? You know, but I think it's more beautiful to look back and say, no, she was trying, you know, she was doing her best that she could at that moment in time. And I think that we can all sort of take that into whatever we do. It doesn't have to be music, you know, and just life in general, and knowing that you tried your best in the moment. And so I do feel like there's some of those, the acknowledgments of that kind of bubbling under some of these songs on this record, but then kind of standing alongside a bit more confidence and just knowledge of what I can bring to the table. And those two things, it's important that they are side by side, because obviously if you have too much confidence, that's a problem too. So I don't think that'll ever be a problem for me, because I'm always like, okay, what are we doing here? Yeah, so I like that. I like that both of those things can be true at the same time.
I mean, always, right? It's like, yeah, not so like black and white, binary, just as you were talking about playing with like kingdom and queendom and all that earlier. When you were talking about how you were protective of your own voice, talking about looking back at who you were at that time from where you are right now, there's such wisdom in that, even at 16, 17 years old, have that kind of self-possession to be like, no, this is me. This is my space. This is my sacred space. You're writing who you are, regardless of what the outcome was, right? Fast forward to album 7 and finally finding yourself in a place where you're welcoming in co-writers, and that's how you're approaching your work. A, do you feel the same as me? Like, do you look back at Sarah, 17 years old, and go, yeah, nice job protecting yourself? And do you think now, having had this experience of working with other co-writers, like, there was a good reason for that? Like, is it affirming, I guess, is what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think, you know, and at the time, having that feeling when I was 17, I think was mostly trusting my gut. And I think that's...
Right, because you didn't have the experience yet.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So trusting my gut, but also, I mean, nobody does anything alone. You know, nobody accomplishes anything alone, really. So it was also, I just feel so lucky and fortunate looking back that from the very beginning, I was surrounded by people who I could trust and that had the best intentions for me as a human first and as a musician second. You know, and I think meeting Gary Pechosa, that was just, he became family instantly, and he almost became like a second. My dad is also named Gary, so I was just easy. I was like, okay, second dad vibes. And so that's very much a part, you know, and then having mentors like Aoife and Sarah Watkins and Chris Thiele and, you know, all these people who just had my best intentions at heart, I truly believe. That was all a part of being able to make those calls back then. And I think having that gut feeling back then. But yeah, I do think it's affirming being in these co-writing situations. I think they were more fruitful at this point than they would have been back then, because I wanted to be doing it. And I was excited to be doing it. And I was driven. It felt like I had more ownership, or just sort of more self-determination to want to be doing it that way. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, just like anything, my husband and I talk about this a lot, where he'll be like, sometimes I say, I'm bad at math. Like, I'm not good at math. And he'll be like, no, you're just not interested in math. And I love that, because it's like, you just have to be interested in something to put the energy into making it good. And that's how I feel with this record, where it was like, finally, I reached this point where it was exciting to me and I was interested in what could come of sitting down with these writers that I felt like I could learn something from. And in fact, there's nothing to lose. There's only something to be gained from sitting down with these people that I admire.
Is there something more vulnerable about that process in a way?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I think writing alone is also incredibly vulnerable. And, you know, you're showing your heart unfiltered or unaffected by somebody else's voice. But to have a song, I think, that feels that vulnerable in a co-write, you do have to go into the co-write being totally open and totally willing. It takes a lot of trust. And to be clear, there are different types of co-writes. You know, I think sometimes when people think Nashville co-write, they think 30 people in a room and there's all these billions of credits.
Break that down for us, please, because I don't even know about how that all works at all. Yeah.
I don't either, because I've never been in that type of situation. But I know that they exist, and it kind of becomes a much more corporate feeling thing very quickly, I would presume. So these, I was still intent on keeping it small. And also me being the one who was picking who I was writing with, not a manager or not a label person saying, you should write with this person. I was like, these are the people I want to write with. If they want to write with me, awesome, let's do it. So there was this very, to your question, there was always this intimate, vulnerable feeling, because it was still, at the most, I was writing with two other people. And yeah, I think it's a beautiful process when songwriters sit in a room and you know, I've experienced that with Aoife and Sarah a ton, and there's so much vulnerability and trust there to get to the song.
Well, let's talk about some of these collaborators, other collaborators. You've mentioned Natalie Hemby and Sarah Buxton, and there's also the producer of this album, which, if I'm getting this right, was also the primary co-writer on this album, Daniel Taschen, right?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
What was it about him that made you feel, you're talking about the necessity of trusting that person, never having worked with him before? What made you trust him? What made you pick him?
Well, initially, Daniel was just on my list of people that I wanted to write with. So I got together with Daniel to write long before I ever considered asking him to produce the record. So the writing came first, and I think that was important in terms of, you know, exploring this new friendship and new creative relationship with someone, of having that experience of like, what is your musical vibe? You know, what, just that discovery. I think the thing about Daniel that was different than the other people that I was writing with was that, so the first song that we wrote together, and it was the first song that was written for this album, was Take the High Road. And basically his vibe is that he sort of demos as, we were demoing as we were writing. And so both things were happening simultaneously. And so I walked away at the end of that day with a demo of the song and kind of these sonic things that he threw on there with synths. And I was in my car listening and I was like, oh my God, this is exactly what I was hoping, you know, that this could be, but it's also exceeded my wildest dreams. And that was the spark moment. I didn't know what type of album I wanted to make until that moment. And then we wrote that song. And in a way, that song is kind of the thesis statement for the album, especially the line, like, I'm tired of being quiet, gonna face up to the fear of trying these things and not being afraid of what anyone thinks. And so the fact that I got to that with him, there was just something kind of symbolic about that, where I was like, if I can write this type of song that makes me feel like I'm still being true to myself as a songwriter and that my voice is the main thing here, and that I didn't feel that that got covered up. I do think that in that moment, I was like, I want to make the record with Daniel. Like, I want him to produce it. But we wound up writing together a ton over the course of the year before we started making plans to actually record the album. Lately, I've been
Take the High Road on Shiro's Radio. And we have Sarah Jarosz with us. Polaroid Lovers is the new album, her seventh. And this was the first song that you and Daniel Tashin wrote together. This says in the notes, the very first day you met, which is like mind-blowing to me that you can just be like, hi, nice to meet you. And then like, boom, like just pour out this song. In these notes that came to me as like a track by track explanation of these songs, which I appreciate very much. Thank you. You also talk about acknowledging your self-worth, that you're not outspoken by nature and that you're generally a people pleaser. And I was like, wow, like way to just be out front with this self-awareness of who you are. I find it so amazing and wonderful that you're able to, despite that, step into the unknown. And it's been such a chapter of that for you. Like really, in the past few years, change has kind of been your theme word of the past few years, I think. Right?
Yeah.
You got married, you moved, you did this record.
Totally, totally. A lot of change. Yeah, I think are you a Gemini too?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. So am I. And yeah, I think acknowledging that I am very much a people pleaser. I want everyone around me to be happy. I want to not disappoint people. I think kind of realizing that about myself more and more over the years. Also, what came with that realization was the realization that in my music, I feel free from that. And that music is the place that I've always just had this kind of knowing and this confidence to explore what's out there. And so I think what I'm working on now is like not having the two things have to be so separate and like bringing those two parts of myself together more and more. And I think that that song kind of is touching on that, where it's like, yeah, this idea of self-worth and acknowledging it, but also letting it go, like being more at peace with things. Maybe I'm getting a little philosophical here, but I think.
Love it. Love it. This is the place. Please go for it.
Yeah. No, I do think things don't have to always exist separately, and just bring all the parts to the front of the room, to the table, and be honest about all of it and about like who I am, and that music is the free place to be able to do that.
That's integration, baby. That's yeah. Like, you know, welcoming in all sides of yourself and integrating them into a whole. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, no wonder you can feel it in the music. You can feel it in this album. Not that there was anything wrong with what you were doing before. Clearly you've had so much success and make incredible music, but it's like there's something about this that's also like you're becoming more and more of an adult. You know, you're in your 30s now, you're married, like there's a whole new chapter here, you know? And again, it's easy to forget when you're somebody that is a public figure, is in the public eye. I definitely was hoping to talk to you a little bit about that, putting on the Shiro's crown for a moment. I always look at young women who come on the show who are, you know, like a Snail Mail, for example, who's like in her barely 20, you know, and she's like experiencing all this success and the good and also the difficult parts of that. I'm not going to call it bad. Mm-hmm. Being seen like that, especially in this social media age and the male gaze and pressures to fit into some sort of, you know, preconceived notions of beauty. Yeah. I'm just going to throw that big ball over to you, Sarah. What has your experience been like? How have you navigated that? And would you have any words of wisdom even to share with a really super young artist who was a woman or a non-binary person that was just starting out in their late teens and early 20s?
Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, my advice and what has consistently helped me anytime that I've started to feel bogged down by outside, you know, pressures or any of the things that you just mentioned. The thing that is my kind of North Star or kind of guiding force is to just bring it back to the music. And even if you're not a musician, bring it back to what the thing that you are passionate about and the thing that you are working on. I think, especially now with social media, it's so much about the look and the content and the videos and the pictures and everything that you're putting out, the visual element of what we do. And, you know, thankfully, so many people are doing so much creative stuff with that. And it's inspiring for me, especially where I feel like kind of being almost elder millennial, it's like the TikTok thing is not my, I have to be taught kind of how to use it. So yeah, but the thing that just keeps me grounded and able to move forward is focusing on the music and focusing on the song and focusing on the people that I'm creating with. And if I'm doing that, then it's much harder for that stuff to kind of get in and get in the way, because then my focus and my intentions are true and they're genuine to who I'm trying to be. And I think for anyone struggling with that, you know, that can really be the thing that turns it around, because suddenly then your brain is not focused on the thing that's trying to slow you down. Your brain is focused on the thing that's going to allow you to move forward. And yeah, if I keep it about the music, if I keep it about the work, that is the thing that keeps me moving forward. I know sometimes it's easier said than done, and I've certainly experienced that. And, you know, also be conscious of who you're surrounding yourself with. You know, this is not always in our control, but as much as it is within your control, if somebody is bringing you down or, you know, discouraging you or making you feel like you're not worth it, get them out of your life, or like do everything that you can to get some space from that person. Because like I said, I've been so fortunate from the very beginning to have people that lifted me up and encouraged me and made me feel like I could do it. And so the more that you can find the people in your community that are doing that for you, that's where it's at. It's all about community and chosen family, you know?
100% agree with everything you just said. And I also want to piggyback on that and say one thing that I've also really admired about you always is that your collaborators have ranged in age. And I think that that's really important. And like, I love to see you doing shows with Sean Colvin. I think that is so important too, to both surround yourself with people that are your peers, but also connect with elders and soak up their wisdom and their knowledge and learn from them. And also there's like a reciprocal energy that happens. Like it helps you as much as it helps them, and vice versa. You know, just talking to Sheryl Crow, like she's talking about all of the young artists that she's both worked with and just in connection with. And it brings her so much, you know, to do that and to be that for them, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned that, because totally, it's a reciprocal energy giver and the wisdom, like you said. And I think that is something that was maybe just more coming from the singer-songwriter folk bluegrass world, that just happens a little more naturally, I think, because I don't know why. Maybe it's just the nature of sitting down in a jam circle, and that the people that are going to be in the jam circle are from all walks of life and all ages. You know, with that being said, I was lucky that when I first started going to the first jam, I was 9, almost 10. And, you know, when I think back on it, it's like these people just were trying to enjoy their Friday night having some beers and relaxing. They could have not been cool. Like they could have been like, can we just get this little kid out of here? But they were cool and they were so encouraging. And so to your point, I think that is something that I'm so interested in. You know, I made the record with John Leventhal and learned so much from him, learned so much from touring with Sean and Mark Cohn. Yeah, but I also felt like that it gave them energy too, to have me there. So it is this beautiful kind of giving of energy that happens.
We have Sarah Jarosz with us on She Rose. The new album is Polaroid Lovers. You've mentioned Aoife and Sarah Watkins, that you have this trio, I'm With Her. Aoife did let slip that there might be a little I'm With Her moment coming up, which I'm very excited about. Don't worry, she kept it all under wraps. That's all she would say. But I did want to explore with you, as I do with pretty much every guest that comes on this show, like talking about you know, the importance of having women around you. And even though there's more and more visibility around women and non-binary and queer artists, the scales are still not quite equalized yet. So I just wanted to explore that with you a little bit. What has that done for you? And is that important to you to see that we work towards more of an equilibrium in all music spaces, whether that be in the live setting, crews, stages, production, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I will focus on Aoife and Sarah because, you know, to be honest, until that band formed, most of my musical collaborations were with men. And I think especially growing up and going to music camps, like I said earlier in the interview, so many of the jams that I would be in, I would be the only girl. And maybe there'd be one other girl. But that was my experience and that was my reality. And like I said, thankfully, that was all really positive for the most part. But I don't know, this thing, it was almost like I didn't know that I needed this experience with Aoife and Sarah so much until it happened. And there was this whole sort of sisterhood feeling that washed over me, and it created this depth of creativity and friendship and support that I do not feel that I had to that extent until we really started making music together. It also, for me too, it was kind of wrapped up in all the work that I had done until that band formed was my solo work under my own name. And I think Sarah Watkins put it like, it's nice to feel like you have a teammate in a band, you know, like we're all equal, we're here for each other and we have each other's backs. And honestly, the time that that came for me, you know, I had made my first four records. And sometimes when I think back on that time, I do wonder if I'm With Her hadn't come along, if I would have burnt out. You know, I had just gone through the whole intense experience of being in college and making two records during that time and touring. And I mean, it was an insane amount of work. And I'm grateful that I put in the work, but it was a lot. It was a lot. And there was some sort of balance that took over when we formed the band. It was like this acknowledgement of life routine, daily routines, how to take care of yourself, going on runs with Aoife, making delicious dinners together. And it was that sort of female acknowledgement of taking care of yourself from the inside out. And I needed that. And that is just something that I feel could only come from two other women. And yeah, it's a beautiful thing. I'm just so grateful for it. I think it made me a better listener as well, musically and as a human, to sort of sit down and write with them. And I can't say enough good things about them. And also the music comes first as well. Like, we're sort of working toward a similar goal and always trying to keep the bar really high and keep challenging each other in a beautiful way as well.
That's funny because you echo something that Aoife and I talked about, because I was talking to her about Ali Russell, who has made this very conscious decision among all of her mission-based activities in music, is to create this band and crew that is female and queer and brown and black and this rainbow coalition that she talks about. And she said to me very clearly, like, until it's normal to see a stage full of women performing, I'm just going to keep making that choice. Now, Aoife's response to that was like, that's amazing. That's not my mission. To me, the music comes first, and I'm not going to hire somebody just because they're a woman. If they are a woman and they're the best person for the job, amazing, but like, that's not going to be priority one. And I respect that so much, and I agree with that. And I was curious, you know, whether you had a similar outlook on it, or having had this experience, because I think this is sort of what I was driving at with her, yeah, was like, having had this experience that you just laid out so beautifully was so impactful and you didn't even know that you needed, but now having experienced it, is that something that you would seek to replicate even in your touring outfit on your own for your solo work? Like, would you make a conscious effort to not just hire somebody because they're a woman, but like, it would be awesome to find like a ripping female drummer to take with me on the road, for example. Or, you know, I mean, I know your husband is the bass player, so I don't want to put anyone else in that role, but.
No, totally. I love this question. I mean, I would fall similarly to Aoife's answer, I think, mm-hmm. you know, and that's in line with sort of what I've been saying this whole time, where the quality of the work comes first to me. And I would be lying if I said that I wouldn't always put that first, you know, and so I wouldn't just hire someone only based off of their identity or how they look or how they, you know, who they are. Yeah, like Aoife said, if they're badass and they're killing it, 100%. And, you know, almost my entire management team is female, queer. So I work alongside tons of women, and just saying, like, that's not stopped me in the past. They're yeah. so good at what they do. Yeah. And that's why I work with them, you know. And I'm thrilled that, like, as a secondary thing, it's all women and this badass thing. Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I'm not putting anyone on the spot. I'm just saying, like, I think it's important to talk this through because mm-hmm. I know I'm guilty of this. Like, I'll go out and see a show, right? And, like, kind of feel like a little bummed out if it's somebody that I love, a female front person, and the rest of the band is always dudes. And I'm just like, oh man, like it would be so cool if there was like at least one more woman out there on stage, you know what I mean? But that's me. I have this mission in life to just want to see more so that everybody else will see more so that it starts to feel more normal. But it's like also not going to serve anyone's purpose if we're just making hires based on somebody's gender or identity. So
right.
I think I'm just more asking like probing questions to try to get at like, where is the solution here so that we can kind of get to that equilibrium?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
100%. Right now, my backing band is all male. If I'm being honest, I think there's also a part of that for my experience, because a lot of my musical experiences have been with men, like I'm comfortable. Like, that's what makes me feel the most empowered if I'm playing alongside like badass guys. And so
right.
I wouldn't want to deny myself that sort of musical experience that is fun for me. But like you said, it's not like I'm doing it also because they're guys. Those are just the guys that I've found that are
right.
the best for this particular project. And
totally.
So I'm not denying a woman that position. It's just that I personally haven't found the woman for the job. And that could just be a timing thing where I am mm-hmm. in my life. So mm-hmm. yeah, it just comes back for me, all of my musical experiences, just wanting to make them the best that they can be and being conscious of who's there, but not to the detriment of the work.
Sarah Jarosz, may this be the first of many conversations that we have. I'm so, of course, loving this time with you. Before we wrap it up, I want to hand you the Shiro's magic wand. And with that wand, you can change anything in the music industry for women, for non-binary people, for basically non-men. First wave of the wand, what would you change?
I think music festival lineups in general. I think there's kind of this ratios. And I feel like that is one place where I look at a lot of music festival lineups and feel like this could be more balanced. And there are deserving, qualified people who, you know, could make this just a musically more interesting day of music for the fans. And yeah, I think that's like the first thing that comes to mind with the wand.
And when this comes up, I always want to shout out the Instagram account Book More Women.
Yeah.
Everybody needs to go and follow that Instagram account because it's a powerful visual tool to see exactly what you're talking about. You familiar with Book
More
Women?
I am, yeah.
Sarah Jarosz, thank you so much for being with us on Shiro's. You're amazing. This new album is incredible. Polaroid Lovers is the new one. Let's go out with a song. What do you want to take us out with?
Let's go out with Columbus in 89th. We kind of touched on it earlier,
yeah.
but it really is, I think, the most personal song on this record for me. Writing the song was like a form of therapy. I had moved from New York to Nashville at the very first week of the pandemic, March 2020. At the time, thinking that I was just getting out of the city for a few weeks, you know, how long could it be? And, you know, fast forward, didn't wind up moving back to New York and settled here. with my now husband, as you mentioned, got married. And then I wrote this song with Daniel, and the song processed the fact that I had turned the page from youth to adulthood. And I cried when we wrote the song because it was like I didn't really acknowledge that that's what had happened until the song was born. And this beautiful idea that change can happen and that it's difficult, but that it can also make way for beautiful, beautiful life, and that both things can be true. You can mourn the past while also celebrating the present and being excited for the future. And so this song holds all of that emotion for me.
I recall staying out with you till sunrise, hit the Hudson without a thought for what had passed and what was coming. Back then I never thought I'd leave, but I can only see as far as the crow flies, and sometimes love leaves me tongue-tied, and once in a while the stars will see the street lights shining in the night at the corner of Columbus and 89.
I love you, Sarah Jarosz.
I love you, Carmel.
Thank you for being with us on She Rose. Congratulations.
Thanks for having me. So special to talk.
Many thanks to Sarah Jarosz for being with us. Her seventh album, Polaroid Lovers, is out now on Rounder Records. She Rose is produced by me, is mixed and mastered by Kelly Drake. Our original theme music is by Lucius. She Rose is also a nationally syndicated radio show. You can visit SheRoseRadio.com to find out more and support our work with Patreon or merch from the She Rose shop. Keep in touch on Instagram and Twitter. I'm at Carmel Holt, or find us at She Rose Radio. And please consider leaving us a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. That helps us grow and bring you more She Rose. Until next time, remember, music is our superpower. I'm Carmel Holt. Thanks for listening.